Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. And hello, a big hello to Sean in studio, and a big hello to all of you. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the latest research from Princeton University regarding adversarial alignment and adversarial collaboration when differences arise. Yep, we need it now. It's a good research. And I'll bring you Chad Ford, a professor of intercultural peace building at BYU in Hawaii and the host of Dangerous Love podcast. And he's the author of Dangerous Love, Transforming Fear and Conflict at Home, at Work, and in the world. See, I told you we need all of those conversations now. I love to hear from you, so connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. But first, I'm going to give you the tip of the week. This week, I've been observing how much staying in denial can be harmful to the person who insists to stay in denial and everyone else around them. I've had the opportunity to see this in people who have addiction or substance abuse, an addiction to substance or a behavior. There's a minimization of their attachment to the substance or the action. There's a minimization of the effect of their addiction on other people around them. Usually they bargain about ways they can control their behavior and stay in denial, and they can't. So then they justify their behavior with some manipulative tactics. I've had the opportunity to observe the denial of a woman who, despite being very unhappy in her marriage, holds on to the fantasy of the beginning time of their relationship, the honeymoon stage, and hoping that their honeymoon stage will come back while, you know, she cries every day in the way that her husband is treating her. And watching the news media to see a major denial of the election process at this point. So what is the reason for staying in denial while the reality is kind of staring at the face? When reality is too hard to handle, we keep staying in denial. When we have to let go of something that was important to us, and the present nor the future appears to be better than what we have, we choose the illusion of denial. When we bargain in our own mind and with others just to keep what we hoped instead of what is, we end up in denial. It's like a coping skill in order to protect us, but unfortunately doesn't. Unfortunately, no matter how long we stay in denial, no matter how much we hope that reality was something else, no matter how much we bargain for something that does not exist, the reality stays as is. We only delay the process, but don't change the reality. It is a much quicker path to accept the reality as is, go through the grief that is awaiting us, and create a goal and an action plan that moves us toward a reality that we envision. The coping mechanism of denial is set up for us not to face the pain. However, subconsciously, we're suffering since we have to deal with the reality on a daily basis anyway. So the resistance creates more harm and a waste of energy. Facing reality might be painful. However, the faster we face what is real in our lives, the faster we go through the grief, the pain, and become more resilient. However, staying in denial only prolongs the pain. We just learn how to justify the pain in the hope of the fantasy that we hope to be there. For an addict, the destruction just continues in the hope of 1 minute of feeling bliss, which does not occur after a while at all, while the only thing that remains are the consequences. For the unhealthy marriage, the unhappiness continues with pain for the couple and their children, with no sign of honeymoon stage ever coming back. And for the election process, I think losing hope, losing respect for the institution, the society, and the sense of community, with the feeling of sorrow, sadness, and fear shows up for everyone, everyone and all around. It is much wiser to face the reality. If you don't know how, and get help. Create the courage and the skill to face all the reality is requiring you to deal with. You can learn the distinctions and skills that would support you to deal with reality with ease and with grace. Check out my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to Creating the Life You Want. So it'll take you through the step by step of observing yourself, your thoughts, your emotions, your behaviors, and maybe how you can be clear with yourself and get out of the internal denial. All right. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with the latest research.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
So let me share with you the latest research. Five social scientists held up in an Amsterdam hotel for a week with a goal of reaching a scientific consensus on how people form stereotypes. Remarkably, they were encouraged by the fact that none of them actually agreed with each other. At a conference in Europe the year before, they had presented their conflicting theories. Those in the audience also, social scientists, wondered how they could comprehensively study stereotypes if they had to choose one model and reject the other. Susan Fisk, Eugene Higgins Professor of Psychology at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, said that people came up to us in complete and utter confusion. We worried that researchers might abandon the entire line of work altogether, so we decided we had to isolate ourselves like Camp David until we could reach a consensus. After a week-long retreat in Amsterdam, the team emerged with a joint theory paper inspired by the experience they also published in How to Guide March 9th and the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. They described what worked and what didn't to bring the adversaries to agreement. Their methods and their success suggest that government funding agencies and foundations might consider other efforts that bring together academics with different viewpoints for the betterment of science. So Susan Fisk said, if people are willing to get into a room together and debate their differences, science can be improved. My God, everything can be improved. The families, government, politics, companies, everything, right? Given that we've all been published in reputable journals, we never thought of it as one theory being right or the other one being wrong. Instead, we thought there would be subtle differences in how those theories play out. Now, can you imagine that in a family system? I'm not wrong, nobody's wrong, but let's just figure this out, right? Or even in companies. After our week together, that's what we found. Her work has long shown that people form stereotypes based on how they perceive the other people's competence and warmth. Yet her adversarial collaborators pointed to other perceived factors such as ideology, or they broke down warmth into being trustworthy and friendly, or advocated morality over everything else. Co-authors reached the agreement that the perceived competence of the person people being considered is clearly one factor in determining stereotypes. A second factor at play is some form of warmth and trustworthiness. This could depend on shared political beliefs and depending on the situation. Perhaps what's most important, however, is that researchers were able to reach an agreement at all by engaging in adversarial collaboration, a concept pioneered by Princeton's Daniel Kahneman, a prominent psychologist and Nobel Prize-winning economist. They were able to design research to answer unresolved issues by engaging in the new idea of adversarial alignment of their theories. They determined that none of them were invalid. Rather, each theory is valid based on a particular situation or the different circumstances in which one theory on stereotypes should be employed over the other. For example, Fisk's emphasis on warmth and confidence works well for groups that people encounter in person, as in new kinds of people in the neighborhood. But for Coach, another researcher in the group, status and ideology works well for an overall analysis of group's location in society. The idea for this collaboration actually arose even earlier than first conference, thanks to Coach, who as a graduate student presented work at the conference that contradicted Fisk's 20 years of research on stereotypes. Like Fisk and Coach's work also found evidence that competency played a role in stereotypes, but instead of warmth, his research pointed to political ideologies. They began by reframing their interactions away from competitive rivalry into a pursuit of joint goal. They also agreed that everyone shared trustworthy intentions, as well as scientific competence, with relation to the goal. To start, they leveled off the playing field, which meant only one researcher from each research group attended, that seniority did not convey privilege, and that prepared descriptions of each model had the same page alignment. They began their discussion with agreed upon premises before debating their differences. They capitalized on shared curiosity as scientists. From there, they moved into producing measurable progress and split off in pairs to begin writing the paper. All of this kind in mind, what they called working toward mutual gain. Working toward mutual gain, as well as the realization that not reaching a resolution would be totally unacceptable. Downside alternative. This created a sense of urgency throughout the experience. A week later, a draft theory paper had formed. The team spent the year revising, submitting, and revising the paper to for the theory journal. Meanwhile, they distilled the main ingredients for their process into a prospectives paper adversarial. Alignment enables competing models to engage in cooperative theory building toward cumulative science, which was published March 9th. The methods have clear implications for academia as well as for policy and the media. Adversarial collaborations on data and adversarial alignments of theory both can enhance scientific credibility among journalists, the public, the members of Congress, which is especially important in an age of misinformation and distrust. So Susan Fisk stated, "We use the behavioral science of multi-party negotiations to resolve our own polarized science building on the model's shared insights that we needed to respect each other's competence and trust each other's intention, and constraining viewpoints on policies, politics, and social norms might profit from our experience as a team of rivals." Absolutely. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Chad Ford for more of this topic.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Chad Fort. He is a professor of intercultural peace building at BYU in Hawaii, the host of Dangerous Love podcast, and he has worked as conflict mediator, facilitator, and consultant for governments, NGOs, and corporations around the world. He previously was the senior editor and writer at ESPN, and his new book, Dangerous Love, Transforming Fear and Conflict at Home, at Work, and in the World, is a personal exploration of how we transform fear and conflict. And my God, we need it right now, Chad. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So first tell me about Hawaii. Where are you in Hawaii?
I'm on the North Shore of Hawaii, where all the great surf is. So it's a beautiful place to live. I live up in the mountains in a place called Pupukea.
Oh, I'm jealous. I love Hawaii. Just love Hawaii. How is it living there? Do you love living there?
I really do. It's a great place to raise a family. I've got 8 kids, so that's a lot of kids to raise. But you know, they're in the ocean or out at the skate park. You know, the weather's always amazing. The people are great. It's been a really great, great place to live.
So no island fever. It's all a lie.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get some island fever, but my work has me traveling really all over the world. And so that's not that big a deal.
Good. So Dangerous Love. Interesting name for the book. So how come you called it Dangerous Love?
Yeah, you know, my publisher and I had a little go around the title of the book, because I think that there's this conception of love that is soft, it's weak, it's romantic love, it means like, and, you know, putting that with dangerous seems like an odd combination. But for me, as a mediator who spent his life helping people work through conflict, I think it's the key ingredient that actually allows people to work through really difficult, challenging conflict. And it's the sort of love that is not because I like you or because I'm attracted to you, but the sort of love that says you matter because you're a human being. You matter because, like me, you have needs, wants, and desires that are really important to you. And because I know mine are important to me, I'm going to take it at face value that yours are important to you, and I'm going to roll up my sleeves and work with you to try to solve that problem together.
Well, having 8 kids, you probably are facing having to calm down conflict all day. So
you probably
have a very good experiential system that you've really created that, how to do that. But you've also analyzed sports, and you also teach peace building. And one of the things that I got from your book is usually people face conflict with a lot of fear. So the first thing that we go through is there's a danger here and it's not going to be to my benefit. So I work a lot, obviously I'm a therapist, and I work a lot with families and business, and then also couples that go through a lot of conflict almost every day. And then obviously as a parent, they have to resolve conflicts for their children. And one of the things that you said in your book is so true, that the first thing that happens is a conflict in front of us, something that we don't like, and it happens in front of us. It's almost immediately our fear shows up. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know that as a therapist, right? That our fears can paralyze us, right? And one of the things that I found so interesting in my work as a mediator is that people have a generalized fear of conflict. So just any sort of conflict is scary to them. And then on top of it, they often have a fear towards the person that they're in conflict with. And when you combine those things together, people actually do the most unhelpful things to resolve conflict while thinking that they're doing the helpful things. So, you know, for example, that classic fight or flight instinct starts to kick in because I'm afraid of conflict, and flight is by far the most common conflict technique. It's conflict avoidance. We just try to run and get as far away from it as we can. We hope that it'll just go away on its own. If we ignore it, if we don't talk about it, or if we just leave and try to get away from it, that it's going to go away on its own. And we know that that might temporarily provide some relief, but it doesn't have long-term benefits. Or if we can't run, we fight. And we think that, okay, I'm not going to be able to get away from this. So I need to protect myself. I need to do what's best for me. And in the process of fighting, I might win. I might be stronger than the other person or more persuasive or more powerful, but I'm damaging the relationship even more now than the relationship was damaged before. And the seeds of the next conflict are being sown right in that very moment. And so it's really amazing when people come in and talk to me about their conflicts. They think that they're doing the right things and they're so frustrated that it's not working. And they take that frustration out on the other person that they're in conflict with. And so a lot of my job is to help show them that these are fear responses. They're not particularly helpful right now. Our fear responses can be helpful to us. You know, if I'm in the water in Hawaii and a shark comes up and my fear response kicks in, I'd want that adrenaline to help me swim faster, to get out of the way or what have you. But when we're in our relationships, I think it's counterproductive.
Absolutely. There's also this concept of kind of like a passive aggressiveness, where at the moment that the conflict arises, I will be quiet and shut down inside. And then later on scheme through how I can, with microaggression and how I can create humiliation or any other tactics that I could create in order to win the game. So another aspect of this is how to maybe not look at a conflict only as how do I win the game versus really looking at what the issue is of the conflict.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about in my book is this distinction between self-preservation and us preservation. And a lot of times in conflict, our feeling is self-preservation, right? And that connects to your game theory, right? Like if it's, what do we do when we play a game? We try to win the game. We don't go out to play the game to lose or to tie. We play it to win. And that's totally appropriate when we're playing games. But when we're with another human being in a relationship, that is not a game. And if I'm constantly trying to win the relationship, then that means that my partner, whoever that is, in whatever setting you want to talk about, is losing the game constantly. And relationships can't be healthy where one partner is constantly winning and the other partner is constantly losing. And so I have to think about my strategy in each of these conflicts is how do I find a solution that works for me because I matter and my needs and wants do matter, but also for the other person. And I think this is where, unfortunately, for a lot of people, we don't do a good job of teaching people how to do collaborative problem solving. We really don't. That we don't teach it in elementary school or in high school. It's not a required course in college, but it should be. If you talk to all these organizations or you talk to marriage experts, they'll all tell you, like, great organizations, great marriages, they're great collaborations, right? They're partnerships, and the people work really well together. They can be different. They can have different points of view. They can come from different backgrounds, but they know how to communicate, work through their issues in a way that work for everybody. But we say that as an ideal, but most of us aren't really ever trained on actually how to do that. Like, what does that actually look like? And so because we don't have the tools, we rely on the tools that we do have. We do know how to run. We do know how to fight. We do know how to be passive aggressive. We also know how to play. We also know how to play dead as well. And I call that, you know, accommodation, where I know that if I just say, okay, whatever you want, the conflict and tension goes away, right? And while I might not at all what I want, at least I got the conflict and tension to go away in the moment. But over time, again, as a short-term strategy, that might be fine. But over a long-term period, that relationship's going to become so uneven, so lopsided, and your needs are going to be so deprived in a situation like that, that you're going to be filled with resentment, and ultimately it's going to break apart.
When you talked about the concept of self against us or instead of us, even as a sport analyst, what shows up that you are, but what shows up for me even in games, yes, we go to play and win that game. But isn't it also that we think about the bigger industry? Like if it's only one team that's, you know, wins every year, doesn't that get boring for everybody, for the bigger industry? And at one point it's like, you know, why would people come in and look at this games anymore? It just seems like in a bigger game of the industry of, for example, basketball or, you know, softball or baseball or any of those, isn't the us as a bigger industry still important for any team or any even member of the team that looks at that as a bigger picture?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, especially when you think about team sports, teams don't win based off of one individual. It helps to have a really talented player. You know, I'm a big basketball fan. And so, you know, it really helps to have LeBron James on your team or, you know, Kobe Bryant or what have you. But you can't, they cannot win on their own. And they've proven that time and time again. They need the right teammates. They need the right coach. They need to get into a system where they benefit others and others benefit them. What's really interesting is that one time I was hired by some members of the U.S. Olympic team to come down and do some conflict work with them. And what was interesting about Olympic athletes in many sports is that it is individual, right? There's the team aspect of winning the team gold, but individuals can also win individual gold medals or silver medals or bronze medals. And if you were to ask this group, which would you prefer, the individual medal or the team medal, most of them would say the individual medal, right? That's what makes them a legend in the sport. But they were riddled with conflict. And one of the things that they had done over time is convince themselves, right, that as long as I'm looking out for myself, everything will go right. But as we started talking, there was a reason I was there, by the way, as we started talking, they did that to all of their relationships. All of their relationships were struggling with their coach, with their parents, with their partners, because that was the only thing that mattered. But at the end of the day, that's not the only thing that matters. All right. And I think that they were winning, but they were miserable winning. Yeah. And you know, the whole point of why you get into sport or a relationship is not to be miserable.
Yes. And even when you look at the one member of the family or a couple, when they're only doing this winning, that's looking at the conflict as how can I win this argument or conflict, or my need is more important than every other member of the family, and not looking at the bigger picture of us as a bigger family. And I know many parents, sometimes they let go of whatever is needed for them in order to take care of their children. So they look at the bigger us, but also in the bigger concept of community. When we look at voting, when we're looking at the politics, when we're looking at all of it, many times the arguments is what's good for my group only. What if it's good for my group, I don't care if it's not good for your group. I'm going to do, you know, fight for that. And obviously anybody who takes a stand, they are taking a stance for what their needs are. So it's not about, okay, let go of your own need in order to take care of somebody else's need, but it's more like take care of your need, but also be respectful and open your mind into looking at us as a bigger group. So we're looking at a, you know, unit of the family, then unit of the work and companies, and then the unit of the city and then societies, and then, you know, country at large and the world at large. If you have a particular state of mind and a state of, you know, values and behaviors, then the same conversation can extend. And that's what you do. You do conflict resolutions with families, corporations, and NGOs and government all together. So you can let us know about how this thing kind of like extends itself to bigger and bigger communities.
Yeah, you know, this same principle of dangerous love isn't just for couples or just isn't for parents and children. In fact, I'm not sure there's any place we may need it more right now than our communities and our country right now, where you literally see families being ripped apart because of political ideology, for example, family members that won't speak to each other anymore, family members that are blocking each other in social media, family members that will not get together during the holidays because so-and-so voted for Donald Trump or so-and-so voted for Joe Biden or, you know, what have you. And we've got to this place of polarization. And I really like the author, Arthur Brooks, who's been writing a little bit about this polarization. He said, you know, the main ingredient that you see throughout our political polarization today is contempt. we feel contempt for the people who have different beliefs, different ideologies than we do. And it's, you know, really interesting, just to take it back to the individual, the Gottman Institute, who has been doing incredible work on marriages for years and what makes a marriage work and what makes it fall apart, list contempt as one of the four horsemen, right, that is going to lead to ultimately to divorce. And the problem is, as a country, we can't get divorced. We can't divorce ourselves. We can't have a Republican country and a Democrat country. I work a lot in the Middle East. We can't have, you know, Israel and a Palestinian and it be separate and different, with the other side just going away and everybody getting back what they wanted. As much as that might be ideal and as much as people might have really strong arguments for why, the reality are there's millions of people now. And so the only way forward is to try to find solutions that work for both of us. But unfortunately, that is not how modern politics work. It's about maximizing our power, maximizing our gains. I hear all the time people say things like, well, elections matter, or tough luck, you know, you lost the election. But the first thing we should be doing if our side won an election was to understand how we work better with the other side, because especially in our country, where it is very, very close, right? There's only a few percentage points between one side and the other. You can't have a functioning country where half the country loses. You just can't. There's not going to be any long-term winners. And I think we've seen that over and over again. And the same thing is true in a relationship, right? You're not going to have a healthy functioning relationship where one side's the winner and one side's the loser. And so if we don't start taking care for these relationships with our neighbors, with our family members, with our community members, and throughout the country, we are going to feel the devastating consequences of destructive conflict. And I think we're already seeing them in the news. We're seeing them on social media. And we got to do something about it now.
Let's talk about the quality of the love that you're talking about, because there is the intentionality of loving and acceptance. As we look at, for example, our the government at this point and our families and talking about things. So there's an intentionality of accepting and loving and knowing that person we love, or even our neighbor. Then it becomes a conversation where it becomes a duality of what I believe is different than what you believe. Then it becomes the communication style. The skills of communication in, you know, do I get frustrated with you? Do I do a character assassination with you? Do I just kind of dismiss you? So then do I belittle you? So it's all of these types of communication skills that come in, which doesn't have anything to do with love. And then in the midst of all of this chat, which I think this piece is a bit new because of the accessibility to the social media, which is a lot of lies and conspiracy theories and shifting the truth from, you know, all sides that you can see. And you can't even find out, you know, it's not necessarily like one source. There's like all of these different sources that come in and just like funnel through. So I found myself having a lot of conversation, which I keep saying the sentence, but that's not true. No, but that's not true. But that's not true. And it's almost like trying to, you know, go inside, finding some pure water out of all this mud water that is there to even have a constructive conversation about what is it that you and I, as two human beings, agree upon, and it works for both of us as a society. And instead of all of these things that might be different, and try to figure out what even is accurate to be able to agree upon.
Well, one of the things that happens in conflict is that our view of ourselves and others get pretty skewed, right? Our view as ourself as right, that, you know, we're the innocent victims here, that we don't have anything to do with the conflict, that everything that's going wrong in my life is happening external to me. And that on the other side of the coin, that what's happening on the other side is is their intentions are always bad. Their intentions are always questionable. They are always trying to think about how they're maximizing their gains, because we never do that, right? And so when you combine those two things together, we have a very skewed view of others and ourselves. One of the things that I always find amazing when I'm working with clients is how great of mind readers they are in conflict. They'll always say, and then I said this, and then the other person thought that. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Is that what they said? Well, no, they didn't say it, but I know that's what they meant or what they intended by it, right? And so when I start putting bad motivations on you, I can't trust you anymore. I have to protect myself. And I start to think about myself and as a victim of your bad intentions. And now I have to put on more armor, dig a bigger moat between you. And, you know, before long, we can't see anything eye to eye anymore. Now you extrapolate that out into millions of people that I will never meet, I will never see, or whatever. It's even easier to believe the worst about them, right? Especially when we get into these bubbles. So, you know, I believe my political opponents sit in basements and drink the blood of babies. I mean, I've literally heard that over the last, few months. And how could any reasonable person believe that that was actually what was happening with any of these top political believers? And the answer is, again, once I start down that path of dehumanizing you, and I think that's really what's happening, right? Is in this conflict, I'm no longer seeing you as a person. I'm seeing you as an object. I'm seeing you as an obstacle that's in my way. And because you're not a person, you're an object, I can put anything sort of on top of you. But now it also justifies me in mistreating you, of using poor language, of even using physical violence or emotional violence towards you, right? Because that's okay. When a cockroach walks across my floor and I step on it, I don't feel any remorse. I don't feel like I've done anything wrong because it's a cockroach, right? But I certainly wouldn't step on another human being. But we're watching video after video where that's exactly how human beings are treating each other. And it's because of that dehumanization. It's a really slippery slope. And so what is the sort of love? And you asked about the quality of love. It's the quality of love that says, I see your value as a human being, and it's not directly connected to you agreeing with me. It's not connected for you doing stuff for me or making my life easier, right? It's not connected to the fact that we have similarities in age or race or religion or political belief or what have you. Your value of a human being exists because you exist. And because of that, I have to find ways, as you said, to find common ground, to find things that we have in common with each other that we can work through together. And I think that in conflict, we forget that. We really start to forget that. And we think that people's value only exists connected to what they do for me.
So the conversation that I hear you and is really the allowing for us to get to know the other person. The allowance of seeing value in your opinion, although it appears at this first time that it doesn't appear to be close to mine, but actually it allows me to grow if I learn some opinions that are beyond my own spectrum. So if I'm just gathering people who only have the same opinions as I do, and so I will stay limited. But if I expand myself and also learning different views, then obviously I will expand myself. So that allowance, the acceptance, the seeing the value on another human being, and all of that. There's another element that is happening in the conversation, which is when some facts are completely delusional or that there's a complete denial that happens with facts. And then in an argument, it becomes very tough to deal with that. And I'm saying this in all around. I'm saying this even in, you know, working with people who have addiction. You know, one of the first things is there's a denial. There's a delusion about what I do to myself. You know, there's a part of me that really thinks I'm taking care of myself by putting poison in my body. So there's a denial that I hold to myself. And, you know, I've worked with addiction for 30 years and dealing with this type of the denial that we go through. We work with couples where, you know, they hold a fantasy inside their own head about, you know, a period of 3 months that there was a honeymoon stage of a relationship, and then the rest is all abuse. But the denial of only if I do this, I will go back into the honeymoon stage. They put themselves into a position of utter abuse for the, you know, for the rest of their life. And then, you know, we see then in the also now the conversation of politics, that there's like delusions and denials that are consistently happening, and we have to work through it. And then so the conversation of I open my eyes and ears and my heart to listen to what's going on with you when you're completely in denial, it becomes very, very hard. And people go through anger and rage about it. Yeah. And then yet seeing that love is the only answer on that one too. However, it seems like the first thing that shows up for people is like, really? Like, really?
You know, I started my book with a quote from a young woman that I was working with in the Middle East, who I was in the middle of teaching her about dangerous love. And she says, but what if he's an evil man? And I started the book that way because that is the reaction often when we're deep in conflict to everything that we've been talking about. I get it. I'm supposed to love people, but you don't know this person the way that I do. They're delusional. They're crazy. They're mean. They're a narcissist. I mean, you fill in the blank. And while I could see how this could work for me and people that I like, it will never work, you know, for them. They're a racist. They're a sexist. They're homophobic. They don't believe in religion. They're an atheist. I mean, you fill in the blank, right? And it disqualifies them from being human in my mind anymore. And those aren't the sorts of people that I want to work with. I don't want to work for solutions with those type of people. And, you know, my response to that, you know, I get that as a young mediator who had a lot of really strong opinions. You know, one of my first jobs was in Northern Ireland and during the, you know, the peace accords. And I used to hear this all the time. We're not going to work with the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. They're terrorists. We don't work with them. We're going to hold a meeting. We're going to have peace accords without them. And we're just going to solve this problem without them. And then, of course, a car would blow up in the parking lot, you know, why they were there to remind you that they're there. We don't often get to choose our neighbors or choose the people in our family. You know, we do get to choose our partners in some ways. But, you know, for so much of our life, figuring out how to work with those people who are the most difficult for us, that is where we need to start getting curious about asking questions about why. Okay, you hold this position. It's repugnant to me. Tell me more about why. And I call it the magic seven whys. The first why might not actually tell you very much. And in fact, it might even offend you more, right? But as you keep asking whys, people usually start talking about their life experiences, things that have happened to them in the past, things that have been painful for them, often trauma that's associated with stuff that's going on. And you start to get introduced to their world and how their views were formed. And while that doesn't make me believe your views any more than it might be, it helps me understand and empathize with why you might see the world that way. And what are those underlying needs that we might agree on? And so often I find it's just the need to for belonging, or a need for meaning, or a need for recognition that, you know, people have. One of my heroes is this man, Daryl Davis, who is an African-American musician who was approached by a person in a bar one day who was white, who said, I've never seen a black person play the piano like that. And the more that they talked, he said, you're the first black person I've ever really had a conversation with. And Daryl just kept asking why and getting curious, and found out the man was a member of the KKK. Wow. But instead of punching the guy in the face or throwing him out or saying, I don't talk to people like that, he just kept asking more why questions. And the more he asked why, the more the guy opened up. And the answer was, he didn't know why he was in the KKK other than it was a group. And they made him feel special, and they made him feel like he belonged to something and that he was important. And because of all of that, he didn't even really believe the ideology, but those things were really important to him. Daryl befriended him, got him to give him his Ku Klux Klan robe. And now Daryl has over 200 Ku Klux Klan robes in his house, just working with members of the Ku Klux Klan. And so for people that say, you can't work with these people, you don't understand them the way that I do, I have my own biases, and I hold the KKK out there is one of the most unreasonable groups. One of the ideologies that I find personally one of the most repugnant ideologies. But here's this African American who was the target of their ideology, who found a way to see their humanity, and in the process turned hundreds, literally hundreds of people away from a hateful ideology. And so I think we have to take a step back and ask ourselves, is that true? Is it true that they won't change? Is it true that there's no redeeming qualities? Are they really evil? Or do they just hold beliefs that I personally find repugnant? Because those are two very different things.
So Chad, what is in that love is also actually an interest, because you actually have to get interested in knowing what other people are about. Because many times we get so bogged down about our own righteousness and the safety that we think we have in our own righteousness that it's easier just to say, I don't care. Like, I don't care what you think. I'm going to find the group that thinks like me, and then we can be a mirror of each other and then keep moving in a direction that, I'm going to enroll other people into what I have in a bigger group. And interestingly enough, part of that construct of enrollment is going to be your intentionality anyway, because even in a conflict that I have to resolve, that means I have to either enroll you, not necessarily to even come to my side, but actually enroll you so that we could come to some common grounds. So that part of enrolling someone takes an interest. It's not just a manipulative act. Yeah. It is sometimes, but it cannot be from where you're coming from, the love. It cannot be only a manipulative act of enrollment. It has to be a genuine interest about another human being and how they are and how they, their idea matters. And then because their idea matters and because they also have the right and they're going to assert their right in some way. So it isn't just me that asserts my right. It's everybody else who also gets to, and they do one way or another, assert their right. So if I just walk into my, a powerful righteousness that let me just enroll the group. So if my group is bigger than yours, then, then I will win to have that genuine interest.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I love that idea. I call it curiosity and intentionality around it. I think part of the problem, and I use this term in the book, Easy Love versus dangerous love. I think our conception of love is skewed. And primarily when we say love, we mean easy love. In other words, when people like us, when they're nice to us, when they send us birthday cards, when they buy us lunch, when they give us massages after a hard day at work, right? When everything is about us, right? That's when I feel love, right? Towards a person. And by the way, the minute that they do something different, right? Now I start to feel I'm out of love, right? It's over, right? Easy love dies. And so at those moments, if I felt love towards that person before, or even if I've never met them before, curiosity is such a huge element in being able to turn my heart back towards them. And the other thing is intentionality. I think we want our relationships just to be easy, to be smooth sailing, to always sort of go our way. And when we hit those rocky waters, instead of saying this is normal, this is part of being in relationship with other human beings, we say something's wrong. Something's wrong here. The water should not be rocky right now. And because they're rocky, I got to figure out how to smooth those waters out as quickly as possible. But because you're causing the wave, the biggest thing I can think of is just to get away. Instead of thinking about, we have to care for our relationships. We have to be intentional about them. We have to constantly be being curious and asking why and reach out. We can't just expect them to come to us or just work for us on our own. We would never think about work, for example, and say work is just supposed to be easy. It's just supposed to come to me, right? We work for our work, right? We work to move up our career. But I'm shocked at how many couples, how many parents, how many children, and certainly how many community members don't take the same approach, right, to us living together. It requires every day. I talk, you know, dangerous love requires work every day around how am I going to be better at seeing this person? How am I going to be better at being helpful to this person? How am I going to continue to build trust and show commitment and show respect towards people? And when we do that well and intentionally, that's how the waters get smooth, not the other way around.
Very true. Very true. So if we hired you as a mediator and a conflict resolution person at this time of transition, what would you say to complete this, this conversation with some high hope in the transition times of going to January 20th?
It's really funny. Just yesterday, you know, someone reached out to me who's been heavily involved in politics that's trying to start this sort of conversation and said, hey, can we talk to you, you know, really quick in 10 minutes, tell me what you would do. And I'm like, okay, really in 10 minutes, right? You know, this is this particular wave of polarization has been built since the 1970s, right? And I gave them this a little analogy that, you know, like if you've ever had oatmeal before and you eat oatmeal and right afterwards you wash out your bowl, it's like slime. You can actually, it'll just rinse right out of the bowl. But if you leave it on the counter all day and don't try to rinse it out until you get tonight, that it comes like glue. It like sticks right to the side. Now imagine that it's been there for 50 years. Right? No wonder people want to throw out the bowl and say, there's no saving this bowl. And so I think the first thing that we have to tell people is that this isn't easy. That's why it's called dangerous love. It's going to be hard. That if you want peace, if you want relationships to go the right direction in your life, you're going to have to put in work to get there. And there's no other way around it. And, you know, so you start there. And then I think we have to start being intentional about finding things that we can work on together and starting to rebuild trust around those things. Instead of going and picking the thing that's the most polarizing thing, I don't want to start with the most polarizing thing. And I always do this in mediations, right? I will hear all the different complaints that the two sides have with each other. And I go for what's the easiest one that we can work on together. And I do that not because I'm lazy, but because I want to show them that we can work together. And they'll say, oh yeah, of course, on the small thing we can, but on the bigger things we can. And I'm like, well, let's just first try something, right? If we're not working together on anything, let's try something at first and let's see how that feels. And let's break down the process. How did that work, right? Why were we able to come to an agreement on that? Okay, now let's pick something a little bit harder. Now let's pick something a little bit harder. And we're going to keep these same principles throughout. And I always talk about three with my clients. First is that I got to see the people that I'm in conflict with as people. If I see them as objects, this whole thing falls apart. We're not going to be able to work, whether that's asking lots of why questions, whether it's getting to know you more, whether that's spending time together, we got to do that. Second, it's inside outside transformation. So I have to look at this problem and say, how am I contributing to the problem? First of all, what sort of elements am I bringing to the table? Because those are the easiest for me to fix. It's much harder to get somebody else to do something differently. But the stuff that I can do, I call it in the book, Turning First, often is the catalyst that's sort of invitational to other people to turn. And then the second thing is, I'm not going to look for easy answers because they're quick or because it makes me have a little check mark by the side of the box. I'm only going to accept solutions that work for both of us. And I'm going to spend the time and energy to keep doing those things. And as I do those things, it gets actually, this is the interesting thing, it gets easier and easier. A lot of times when I'm working with clients, by the time we get to the big thing that drove them there, they already have the solution to the problem. They're already there. They can figure it out. I don't have to say a word anymore. And so it's just getting us back into that spirit again.
Beautiful. Chat for everyone. Dangerous love, transforming fear and conflict at home, at work, and in the world. And you can find him his books in dangerouslovebook.com. Last words.
Just thanks so much for having me. And for those that have been following along, this is a really important conversation to have. And I hope that whether it's reading the book or going to a podcast or just watching this podcast, that maybe it inspires you to have a difficult conversation with someone in your life today. And not in a blaming way, but in a way that, again, helps create understanding, helps you learn more about the person, and helps the healing. It starts at home. And as we get good at it at home, it can spread throughout our communities in the world.
I think it starts at inside of our head pretty much first, right? If we can create that type of love and understanding and curiosity in between or the states that we go through, then, as you say, then outside, and then the bigger and bigger picture that we look at the world. So thank you, everyone, for listening to us with your heart. Thank you for being with us. And until next week, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. Bye-bye.